Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. We're coming to you. Well, right now we're live. I guess you might hear us on
a
podcast.
Live.
But we're live at this moment. I feel alive. I feel lively.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming to you from our Glaston studio at the beautiful Line Hotel here in Washington, D.C. You should be here. It's a happening place. And today we're really going to get into not only an interesting subject, but an elemental, essential subject about the diet that feeds our bodies. I'll start from the start. Dr. Bill Schindler, he's got a lot of things going for him. He's the director of the Eastern Shore Food Lab. He's an associate professor of anthropology and archaeology at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. And he's the co-star of the National Geographic series, The Great Human Race. And I guess your whole thesis platform is that prehistoric man and woman had a diet and had a
way of life.
A way of living and a way of acquiring their food that actually was better for them than the way we do it now. And that what we need to do is to get back to that, to some of the basics. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Sure, absolutely. So our dietary past, and this past is a past that's millions of years old, is the platform from which we should have every conversation about food. That's where we need to begin, and that's where we need to get back to first.
Okay, so why don't we start a little bit with your background?
Sure.
What led you to dive in deep on this?
Well, several things. I grew up in New Jersey, in Monmouth County, New Jersey.
I'm from Morris County, New Jersey.
Oh, there you go.
There we go. I'm a Jersey girl.
What exit, Bill?
Can't you tell?
109. Exit 109.
Okay, that is so fucking stupid, just for the record. Okay?
That's what people say.
I know, and it's a dumb thing to say. Like, I'm not off any exit.
Yes, you are. You're off exit 10.
Yes, not off the turnpike.
Yes, you are.
Uh-uh.
That's what your exit
okay.
is.
Anyway, whatever.
109 off the park.
Okay. Whatever.
So I grew up right on the train line to New York City. All my friends had their parents, were working in New York City. And my father tried very hard to have me exposed to nature in ways that the people around me weren't, it wasn't very easily accessible to them. So he had me hunting and fishing and trapping and camping regularly. And
wow.
But we had to drive quite a distance to do, or at least we thought we had to for many of these things.
Where'd you go, to Pennsylvania or up north?
We spent a lot of time at the Delaware War to get.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And my mother had me in the kitchen. My grandmother had me in the kitchen regularly. I was watching Julia Child since I was 5 years old. I was very interested in food. And then later on, I became a Division I athlete, wrestled for Ohio State, and then later the College of New Jersey. And obviously, there's a huge link between athletics and food.
Of course.
But definitely wrestling and food. Unfortunately, it's not the best relationship always.
No, that's a very unhealthy relationship with food when it comes to wrestling and food, especially if you're trying to keep a certain weight.
Absolutely. In
right?
fact, when I was in college, there was 1 year where three kids from three different colleges died cutting weight that year.
We'll hit that topic on another show.
Now I'm depressed.
Well, I can make you happy. Food has always been a part of my life in some way, and in many cases, very important part. My parents hired nutritionists for me when I was in high school, and we had nutritional counseling, obviously, in college. And then later on, after I finished, I was very interested, always very interested in being a part of my food system from the very beginning as much as possible. So the hunting and the foraging and the fishing and all that led into it. And really, the reason I became an archaeologist was because of that. I never enjoyed killing, but I always felt the connection with my food by being out and hunting and being
sure.
a part of that entire process. But picking up a gun and going hunting wasn't enough. I wanted that connection more and more, so I learned to make bows, and then I learned to make arrows, and I realized I needed to make arrowheads to put on the end of the arrow. But when I learned how to do that, I realized that I wanted to not only use a stone point for the kill this deer, but I wanted to use the same kind of stone point that somebody in that place in New Jersey 2,000 years ago. So I realized I had to turn the arcuation.
That's called diving in.
It's also a little bit deep. A little obsessive,
it's,
but okay.
It's obsessive. But what the main part of that.
I mean, no judgment, but I'm just saying. We have a kid with OCD. We understand it.
Well, the part of archaeology that I became very interested in was called experimental archaeology. So, in addition to excavating, you know, archaeological sites, mm-hmm. experimental archaeologists replicate the technologies that people in the past used to better understand what we're pulling out of the ground. So,
and is that a new form of archaeology? I mean, is that something new that people are doing, this experimental way of like trying to recreate and relive? Is that a new way of doing things, or has it been around for a long time?
People at some level have been doing it for hundreds of years.
Okay.
But it became a sort of a big thing in the 70s. It died off a little bit in the 80s and now has a huge resurgence.
I bet.
And it's wonderful. It's a great teaching tool, great research tool, great connection.
You
tool.
May want to go on Survivor sometime too.
Perhaps.
There you go.
He's like, that's in the
Yeah, we can talk about that later. Okay. So anyhow, I was very fortunate when I realized that that's what I wanted to do. I put myself in the same space as some of the best primitive technologies in the world. I learned how to flint knap from one of the best flint knappers in the world. I learned how to make stone tools from one of the best stone tool replicators in the world.
Who is that?
Dr. Eric Callahan from Lynchburg, Virginia.
Okay, and what did he teach you how to make?
He taught me how to replicate stone tool technology over millions of years.
Wow.
And in fact, we'll talk more about stone tool technology in a minute because it's very important to this conversation. But I learned how to make replicate prehistoric ceramics and tan hides and do all these sorts of things that really connected me to my past in ways that there's no other way to do it. It's like a virtual time machine.
Mm-hmm.
So that became my focus. I got my PhD in that, and I've been teaching now. I taught at Monmouth University, and now I teach at Washington College for 10 years. And when we started having kids, my wife started coming out into the garage or out in the driveway. She said, you got to come in the house. Like, come in, stop banging on the rocks and come in the house. You know, we have a family. And, you know, the short story is that she said, can you please find a way to take all these things you're passionate about and do it in the house, mm-hmm. you know, and do it for the family? And I thought long and hard about how I could connect all these things together. And what I realized is that almost every single prehistoric technology has something to do with food.
Okay.
Getting food, processing food, cooking food, distributing food, storing food, period.
Mm-hmm.
And I really started to focus all of my energies 10 or so years ago on purely that, looking at ancestral diets and trying to, most importantly, figure out how a firm understanding of our dietary past can help us in our dietary present.
Okay, so where do we start here? How do we break this down?
Okay, so here's the story. So for a moment, just for the next rest of however long we're together for tonight, for a moment, forget everything or put aside everything that you've been told, that you read, that you've seen on TV, anything at all to do about human diet and health.
Okay.
Just a second.
Done.
And let's look at it from a completely different perspective, because all those, there's some great information out there. It's all biased. Most of it, believe it or not, disconnects us from our food in some way, and I believe is the wrong approach. So here's the way I like to think about it. Humans are one of the weakest species on the planet. We have an incredibly difficult time getting resources from our environment. Our nails are useless, our teeth are useless, we can't run very fast, we're not that strong, we can't jump, we can't swim, we can't fly compared to other animals. So getting resources from our environment is very, very difficult to do. But what's even worse, what's even more traumatic, is that we have one of the weakest digestive systems of any animal on the planet. So even if we can get a resource from our environment, our ability to turn that resource into
energy, nutrients
for our bodies mm-hmm. is severely compromised. It's severely limited, even in healthy individuals. So the story begins at about 5 million years ago, when we first stand upright. Somewhere between 5 and 7 million years ago, our ancestors first stood upright. And that came with a lot of consequences. One is, it came with the most painful and dangerous childbirth of any animal on the planet.
I can attest to that.
I can't attest to it, but I can.
I've never felt a thing. Okay. I want to say
all five
that.
Times.
We have back problems, all sorts of. But one of the trade-offs directly relevant to this conversation is that our guts shrank almost in half. So our gut size right now is about 60% of what it would be in a similar sized primate. And that severely compromises our ability to digest food and do what it needs to do with the food. At that time, we were herbivores, frugivores, and possibly insectivores. I mean, that was our diet. Think
herbivores,
about
herbivores. What was the second one?
Frugivores. So we're eating
fruits,
vegetables, and maybe insects.
And bugs.
And bugs.
I know what bugs are.
And I mean, think about what you could do with just your body going out and getting food from the environment. You can't get that much. About 3.5 million years ago, the entire game changes in an instant. One of our ancestors picks up two rocks, struck one against the other, and knocked off a razor-sharp flake. And in that instant, began to completely transform our relationship with our environment. We're no longer limited to these nails and these teeth. Mm-hmm. We can transcend these physical limitations and, for the first time, butcher animals on the savannah. We weren't hunting at this time, but we were getting meat from and cracking open bones from marrow. And then later on, at about 2 million years ago, we control fire, and we begin to hunt. And then we ferment, and then we soak and grind and nixtamalize and do all these other sorts of things. The story, the most important takeaway message from looking at our dietary past is that these technologies and behavior patterns that we invented were focused on nutrient density and bioavailability. We create technologies and behavior patterns to get the most nutrient density.
And that was all instinctual. I mean, it had nothing to do with any knowledge. It was...
Yes,
I mean,
and no.
It had to be.
So it had to be, but here's a pretty cool thing, and maybe we're doing this out of order, but a lot of the things that we do to our food mimics what other animals do naturally in their own digestive tracts.
For example, fermentation is a great example, right? Because fermented foods really aid in digestion.
Absolutely. So a cow can feed on, should be eating grass, right? So
right.
You put a cow in a pasture and it's eating grass.
Sure.
We could stand right next to that cow, eat the same grass and die of starvation. But meanwhile,
sure.
Because they have this huge fermentation chamber at the beginning of their stomach,
mm-hmm.
We ferment outside of our bodies.
Sure.
This is another great example. So I brought you some long fermented sourdough bread that I made, and
it's beautiful.
Thank you.
It is beautiful.
Here's, I was doing a television piece for Irish Public Television last year,
mm-hmm.
And there's a series called What Are You Eating? And it was in its third season, and they contacted me right before their first episode. And listen, we're filming the first episode. We'd like you to be on it. I said, great. What's it about? And he said, it's about veganism. And I said, I think you have the wrong person. I don't know much about this.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't know much about being a vegan. I think you have the wrong person for this. So I said, no. This is what we're going to do. We're going to take the host, and he is going to get a whole bunch of blood work done. And then he's going to go on a vegan diet for a month and then get a whole bunch of blood work done afterwards. And during that month, he's going to interview a bunch of the leaders in the vegan community in Ireland. And what he'd like to do at the end is have you on and talk about our relationship with animals in our dietary past.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, that's great. So can I bring some students? And he said, yeah. So we brought some students out, and we were by Powers Court Waterfall just south of Dublin. This gorgeous.
We've been there.
You know,
it's fabulous.
So we were right there. The waterfall's in the background. A friend of mine, Jason O'Brien, got us two deer, two rabbits, and two ducks.
Okay.
And I had this huge spread of all of our ancestors' tools, and I had students elbow deep butchering with stone tools and these deer carcasses and all this, and that I was walking him through.
That sounds like a bloody mess, but yes,
it was,
go ahead.
Actually, I can't believe they showed what they showed. They showed more than National Geographic would have showed in the final episode. But we're at this one point, and it was just one of these light bulb moments for me, and this is results in this bread. There's a connection, I promise.
Okay.
So the host says to me, he says, can you grab one of those ducks and, you know, clean that duck out as we're talking? I said, sure. So I cut to the bottom, and I reach up inside of this duck, and, you know, the camera's filming it, and I grabbed all the insides, and I'm pulling it out. And in that moment, I had this sort of epiphany. And it was one of those moments where you're still trying to do what you need to do because the camera and everything else is happening, but my mind is spinning at the same time, and so many things fell into place at the same moment. I reached up all the way up to its neck, and I grabbed the crop.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what the crop is?
No idea.
Okay, so I pull out the inside of this duck, and in my hands, at the top of the digestive tract, is a crop, and it's this enlarged muscular pouch in the esophagus, and it's warm and it's moist, and when a duck eats grains,
mm-hmm.
barley in this case, it takes the whole seed, and it swallows the seed whole, and it sits in this thing for sometimes 12 to 16 hours.
Huh.
And during that time, it soaks,
and ferments.
It ferments, and sometimes even sprouts. And then this softened, soaked, sprouted, fermented grain goes down to its gizzard, which are two muscular discs, and in between that are all the rocks that it eats to grind it.
Mm-hmm.
And the day before, I had just been with this amazing archaeologist by the name of Seamus Caulfield, and we were using a cornstone, which is exactly that. It's a stone, just two stone
grinders
to grind it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at this duck, and I'm looking at the crop, and I'm looking at the gizzard, And then I look at the rest of that the digestive tract, which is very smaller, but very similar to ours. And I'm thinking to myself, if I took a grain and bypassed this crop and this gizzard and stuck it in a digestive tract that was very similar to ours, what would happen to that duck if I didn't soak it and ferment it and grind it and do all of those things? It would get sick or it would die of malnutrition or phytic acid, whatever.
Right.
And that's exactly what we do when we make long fermented sourdough breads.
Okay.
We're doing exactly what's happening naturally in that duck. It's the same thing with a cow and we ferment outside of our bodies. Or, you know, another great example, I have some fermented butter here for you to try as well. But Ireland is known for its dairy for a number of reasons. And it has amazing dairy. And I get questions all the time, you know, should humans be eating meat? Should we be eating bread? Should we be eating dairy? Especially should we be eating dairy as adults? And what we do with dairy, when we do it right, is mimic exactly what's happening in a mammal child, right? So a mammal child, even humans, will take in milk from its mother, and it'll go into its stomach. The milk will go into its stomach, and several things happen right away. One is chymosin in the stomach, which is rennet, will coagulate the milk, and then it will ferment, and the lactase will eat the lactose and all that as well. But what happens is if a baby takes in liquid, it'll pass and it stays a liquid. It'll pass through its digestive tract way too quickly for it to absorb all the nutrients.
The nutrients, right?
But if it coagulates it, not only will it sit there longer and allow it to without getting more nutrition from it, but it will also ferment, which does wonderful things. So when a baby spits up on your shoulder and it looks like cottage cheese, it is.
That's why, right, because it's been fermented.
It's made cheese. So if the questions that we ask, I believe, I don't have all the answers, obviously, but I think I know how to ask some of these questions. Should humans be eating bread? Should humans be eating dairy? Should humans be eating meat? Is the wrong question. In fact, we are not designed to eat any of those things. We are not designed to eat meat. We're not designed to eat grains. We're not designed to have dairy as adults. But it's irrelevant because it's the wrong question.
What's the right question?
The right question is, what foods do our bodies require? What are the foods that we found out the ways to unlock the nutrients from that we literally built these bodies on? How do we take these resources and transform them into the most nutrient-dense food possible? Because as soon as we struck our first stone tool, are we designed to eat this? Are we designed to eat that? Those questions are irrelevant because
we're going to eat it.
Well, we're going to find a way to extract the most amount of nutrition from it.
Let me take you back to before man and woman walked on two legs.
Okay.
Did we have, and our bellies shrunk, did we have this fermentation capability at that point? Were we like other mammals?
When we were Neanderthals?
No, not
Neanderthals. Much
later. Yeah, that's later. But I mean,
when we were
crawling around in the muck and the mire, you know.
I don't know enough to know exactly what those digestive tracts were like. We first appear as mammals around the same time as dinosaurs were. We were a nocturnal shrew. All of our ancestors began as a nocturnal shrew.
I know some shrews.
Yeah. and then we changed over a lot.
Okay.
So once we are standing upright and we developed tools, how did early man eat? What were they eating?
Anything that they could get. Anything that they could transfer. Right. So we were hunters and gatherers for our entire existence up until 12 to 15,000 years ago, obviously.
Okay. It's not obvious. I don't think people understand.
I mean,
you know what I mean? Like, I don't think people understand the trajectory and how it all started and how it evolved to where we are now. I mean, it's easy to look at the last 200 years with industrialization and to see the processed food and what happened. The last 200 years are probably...
can't you look at Native Americans and basically see they were hunters and gatherers and they hunted and gathered what was around them?
Yes, but they were also farming for much of their... For the past several thousand
true.
Years
You're
as
right.
well. So let me give a couple markers, time markers.
That would be very helpful.
So we first stand upright.
And can I just interrupt? I feel like you should really cut into that bread.
Oh, here, I'm sorry.
Because it's so gorgeous.
Usually I'm the one that says, cut the goddamn bread already.
When later in the show, I'd like to talk about the importance of the sprouted ingredients in the bread and the fermented butter, because I don't think people think of butter as being fermented.
Well, is this, and the question is because this bread is fermented, this sourdough, and it's fermented
butter.
But
it's sprouted, right?
This is soaked. These grains have been soaked, and the grains have been fermented. There's nothing sprouted in this.
Okay, all right,
is that on the diet or not on the diet?
This is good.
Not that I stuck to the diet.
Oh, for you?
But yeah.
Oh, should be tonight.
It is. I think it is.
And this is fermented butter, and we can talk more about that. But that butter is completely alive with the same.
So what does that mean?
Does it taste different?
So it should. Yeah. The
butter
is at least. See, that's a very Icelandic way to put butter on toast.
Oh my God.
That's perfect.
The bread is great.
Thank you.
You mean like a lot?
Yeah. They told me in Iceland last year that the thickness of the butter should at least be the same thickness as the bread.
They eat very well there.
Yeah, they sure
do.
Butter.
Thank you.
Most butter today is made sweet cream butter. It's completely dead. It's a completely dead food.
Okay.
Butter in the past. And we think butter is at least 6,000 years old, probably invented in Ireland. Mm. And spread throughout the world by Vikings.
This butter is sort of salty and tart.
It is. It's slightly tart, and that's because of the fermentation. But all butter up until historic times, and even during much history, and even other parts of the world right now, is completely alive food. It's fermented.
Okay.
Which has several...
So how is butter fermented?
Okay, so...
Does it ferment naturally?
If we use raw milk, it does.
Okay.
So
not pasteurized.
Yes. If we use pasteurized cream, we have to inoculate it with something to start the fermentation.
That
like
makes
making
sense.
Cheese.
Got it.
So I usually inoculate it with kefir, which works great.
Sure.
But raw. Think about a farmer with just one or two cows.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go out and milk the cows and come back and fill the pot with the milk and let it slowly separate. And they'd skim off the cream and they'd put it over here to churn it into butter. But there's not enough cream to spend all that time churning into butter, so they let it sit. And the next day, they do it again. And after 3 or 4 days, there's enough cream there to churn it into butter. But that entire time, it's been fermenting.
Right.
Interesting.
And then they churn it into butter, and several things happen. One is it's completely alive. Two is the flavor profile changes in some very wonderful ways. The yield is higher. And it's a much more storable product as well.
So this is it's so delicious.
You can. This sounds wrong, but you can bake my bread anytime you want.
But as a fermented butter, it's healthier.
Absolutely.
For humans, because it aids in digestion.
And it's a completely probiotic food. This is probiotic, like kefir or yogurt.
Right. So we had we were enlightened a year ago. We had the people from Hex Ferments. Which is a Baltimore group that makes all this fermented. They do,
Krauts and
kimchis and slaws and then kombuchas. And she actually learned about kombucha in Ireland.
Really?
It was the first time she had kombucha years ago. And, it was so interesting to find out that you could make these foods or have these foods. And if you looked at history... And you looked at how people ate and how fermented foods have always sort of been a part of people's diets. Because if you were eating fatty meats or things of that nature, like if you look at, Koreans and the kimchi, like where the kimchi is added, the pickles at the beginning of the meal, or even Eastern European diets, or Jewish diets, you used to go to a deli and there'd be pickle platters and slaws and things like that to aid with the fatty meats and things of that nature. So it's really interesting to see how it's added, but people don't really know why it's there.
Right.
There's no education to that.
No, and we were just in Mexico a couple weeks ago. I had my family.
You travel a lot.
You travel a
we
lot.
Do. There's so much to learn. There's people doing such amazing things with food, and through the approach that we're taking to this, we have a lot to learn, and people are still doing, in traditional indigenous groups are still doing such wonderful things. We were in Mexico studying nixtamalization of maize, and we ended up in Hidalgo, with the head of Weston Price Mexico, this wonderful woman named Galia, and we had barbacoa and pulque. So barbacoa is a sort of a pit roasted, usually lamb, but it could be anything.
Very it's barbecue.
Very fatty meat.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to eat it at the same time you're drinking pulque, which is a wild fermented beverage. And the idea is that it actually helps with the digestion.
Right. Isn't that amazing? It's so funny. All right, so let's... we've already interrupted ourselves, but it's all
very interesting.
So
we're crawling around in the
Here's the Cliff Notes sort of version of our past. So we started about 5 to 7 million years ago, we first stand upright.
Mm-hmm.
Our guts shrink. We're not making any tools at this time. We're probably eating plants, fruits, and insects. Very limited diet. Nothing about that is very nutrient dense. Perhaps the insects.
And not enough, right?
No.
Were they hungry?
We're small. I mean, I know you can't see, but full grown adult is maybe 3.5 feet tall.
Okay,
maybe.
Tiny.
Small brains. Women, by the way, females are much smaller than men at this time. There's a high degree of what we call sexual dimorphism. And the reason we think that's the case, very diet-related, is because the three most nutritionally expensive, important times in a female's life is when she's young, mm-hmm. when she's pregnant, when she's lactating. And if something about that gets messed up, the population doesn't continue, right? Mm-hmm. So they're kept small to keep, we think, naturally, so that the dietary requirements going into pregnancy and lactating are
already
small.
Them, right.
So this is what's happening. And then about 3.3 million years ago, the first stone tool we ever found dates to this time period. Mm-hmm. And it is at the same time that we start seeing butchering remains. So we found bones of several different animals that have butchering marks on them made by stone tools. And those bones are getting cracked open for marrow.
Now, and are they? Is the thought that they're eating dead animals? Or are they killing animals?
No, there's no hunting. And this is really...
I once heard the theory that man didn't start eating cooked animals until there was probably a forest fire. Animals got caught in that. The meat's cooked up, smells good, checks it out. And then we've got tailgating, you know.
Well, these are scavenged kills that other predators have killed. And this is a really important point to the next milestone. So we study these predators in the African savanna now and understand how predators kill and how they eat and what their patterns are. So when they kill something, they go in there and they gorge themselves on all the insides, all the blood and the fat and the organs, and then they gorge themselves and go off and sleep on a rock or up in a tree. And there's a limited amount of time that you could then go in and cut off pieces of meat. And this is exactly what our ancestors are doing 3.5 million years ago.
Okay.
But we don't see a huge change in body size at this time. There's not a huge change in brain size. And one of the most important things that I think we can say about that is that it's not about meat. We use the word meat and animal synonymously.
Which is not true.
No. Because the biggest change in body size, the biggest change in brain size happens 2 million years ago when we do two things, transformative, control fire and start hunting. And when we start hunting, we have first access to the most nutrient-dense part of the animal.
Which are the organs.
The organs, the fat, the blood, the brain.
Sure.
So, if this idea about our dietary past and the important pieces have to do with nutrient density, look, vegetables, fruits, amazing.
Right, but important. But
they're not nutrient dense. They're water and air and nowadays sugar. I mean, that's what they are. Meat is more nutrient dense than that, but it's the least nutrient dense part of an animal. And that's the only parts that we focus on really right now as modern Westerners, really.
Sure.
So at 2 million years ago, we're hunting and we're controlling fire and cooking. And then, you know, as time goes on, we're continuing to do all of our things better. We're figuring out how to detoxify all sorts of plants from our environment. So
wait, I'm going to cut you off here because we need to take a break.
Okay.
So when we come back, we can dive deep right into this. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Industry Night. We're in the gorgeous Lion Hotel and we are getting a deep dive into what humans should be eating. We'll be back in just a sec.
Tuned in to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, only available on Full Service Radio. We'll be right back.
Okay. That wild music. Yeah. Music. All right. So we're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. David and Nikki Nellis. We're talking to Dr. Bill Schindler about...
I'm eating bread. Can you hear?
Yeah. Nikki's eating bread.
A lot of it.
Everybody. We should get this on film because that doesn't happen very often.
It's delicious.
So I asked you during the break, sure. You know, we're talking about... Essentially, we're talking about getting back to the way we mm-hmm. nurtured ourselves when it was a natural thing, when it was instinct, as opposed to
sure.
other things. But now, you know, to do that today, like I was on the paleo diet for a while, and then I fell off the wagon. But in order to do that the way they did, you've got to
think
about...
That's a whole other show.
That's a whole other show.
You're eating bread. Shut up. Anyways, but... you know, you have to start thinking about the quality of the meat you're eating, mm-hmm. antibiotics, and, you know, were they fed grain or were they grass-fed and were they pasture-raised, that kind of stuff. So that complicates your mission.
Oh, it does. Although, you know, we see these things as distractions or problems with, you know, having to think this much about our food. It's actually a privilege to be able to think this much about our food. But
right, because it's available and you can ask yeah. questions and we can find answers, whereas there are people who are trying to find food.
Right.
Where, I mean...
So for a minute, let's talk about our opportunity, what we should be doing if we have access to the right kinds of resources, how mm-hmm. we should be thinking. This is how I think about it. Where food comes from, the quality of the... All of that is super important. And the final product, its taste and its presentation and its smell, and all, it's super important. The part that we need to focus on more is what happens between those two ends, the beginning and the end. Because this, what we've done for 3.5 million years is take raw materials we have no business eating and transform them into the most nutrient-dense, bioavailable foods imaginable. That's what we've always done, and that's awesome. So the ability for our guts to shrink almost in half and our bodies to grow as big as they have, our brains, 20% of our of the nutrition we take in go to fuel our brains. Other animals is 20%. For our ability to do that mm-hmm. means that, you know, that story is triumphant. That's amazing. But here's the story. Here's the problem. Now we produce in the same individual obesity and malnutrition. Our food is so nutrient free that we can do something that's virtually impossible to do that. So my approach is, and the way I think we need to think about food, is to think about all of those technologies and behavior patterns that allow us to transform our raw ingredients. So when we talk about, we shouldn't even begin to have discussions about GMOs and what crops, how closely together we can pack stalks of corn to have more food. We shouldn't have any of those kinds of discussions until we've figured out a way to kind of recapture or step back and say, here's a resource. Let me take the most amount of nutrition from that resource and put it on somebody's plate. Because mm-hmm. we're not doing that. We're stripping. We're taking an animal like a cow or a pig and putting only half of it on the grocery store shelves. We're taking corn and barley and wheat and stripping it of nutrients and putting them in a bag and then asking how many more acres of corn we have to plant.
Right.
You know, it's ridiculous. So we need to, in my mind, go back and figure out, re-engage with those technologies.
Well, talk about the cow.
Yeah.
Organ meats, is that what we should be eating? I mean, you know, we're eating the ribs and we're eating the, you know, the ribeye and all that.
Yeah.
But should we be eating the liver and the heart?
100%. Think about how crazy this is. This is how we approach those of us who eat meat. A typical modern American eat 3 different animals and almost the same cut of meat every week from those same animals.
You're 100% right.
How unnatural is that?
Chicken breast.
I mean, and that's the craziest thing ever, too. I mean, we've taken a bird, put it under captivity, produced a meat that you don't find anywhere else in nature
mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't fly. It's the most, meat is the least nutrient-dense part of an animal anyhow, and the chicken breast is the least nutrient-dense part
right.
of a chicken, and then forced people into thinking that's the healthiest part. And then we did the same thing with pork.
That's mass agriculture, making big animals, and... I mean, right. that's marketing.
So if you could take that ad, think about, first of all, I do believe our bodies, our species, was founded on a diet that included animals. Not meat, animals. I think we eat way too much meat today. We don't eat enough of the animal, but we eat way too much meat.
Mm-hmm.
So I am very interested and passionate about animal rights, the ethics surrounding animals, raising animals the right way, treating them the right way, but doing it in a way that includes animals in our diet. And there's ways to do that. But if you take an animal, I don't care how you raised it, butcher it, and only put half of it in a grocery store,
right,
there's something wrong.
Well, actually, yesterday, so we had on our other show, we had the Jamesons on. They have a farm, mm-hmm. a lamb farm. And that's one of the things that we talked about with them because, you know, there was sort of a trend for a little bit.
Nose to tail.
For, sure. you know, for of doing whole animals in restaurants. But the problem is that if people want, it, you got to sell the whole animal and you have to educate people on the different
sure.
cuts because they're not. Because we've lost that somewhere along the
well,
line.
Well, but that's not exactly what they said. They said originally when they started raising lambs, you know, they were selling the rack and, you know, a couple other things. And what do we do with the rest of the lamb? But now the stomach and the, I mean, there's more that's mm-hmm. made it to the plate. So, but there's still, I mean, Victor Albizu is a prominent chef here. And he, I mean, lamb is prominent on his menu. And he'll roast a whole lamb over a fire, and
yes.
you're getting everything. I
Good.
Mean, the whole thing.
So let's go back a little historically. So 2 million years ago, there was
I'm
a
having
huge,
more bread.
Okay, there was a huge change. And then if we look, when does the change happen in the last two centuries? Like, when do things start changing negatively? When do, or not negatively, but how did we get up? How did we get here?
World War II.
So first, the only major step that we miss is when Homo sapiens appear, when we appear.
Okay.
So we appear, it looks like now, 300,000 years ago.
So okay.
Modern day Homo sapiens, essentially the same as us, same digestive tract. I mean, our microflora is different, but that's, you know, that's
right.
environmental.
Area.
But so same size as us, same brain size, same gut size. We appear 300,000 years ago. And I bring that up because I do believe if, you know, our bodies were only, could only be supported by the diet that we had there. It was an amazing diet that allowed mm-hmm. us to not only appear, but also to survive and reproduce for 300,000 years. So I do think we need to look into the past for some inspiration and knowledge.
Okay.
Things start to go really, really bad. I think, well, things change certainly when we start farming. Our resource base completely transforms. Not it isn't all bad, but it definitely transforms. So we begin
When does farming start ish?
The first plant domestication is probably somewhere around 15,000 years ago, give or take several thousand
okay.
years. Animal domestication.
And is it in the Fertile Crescent? Where is
it's
it?
It's all over the world in different pockets. In fact, maize probably in the Balsas Valley of Mexico is one of the first domesticated plants on the planet. But the major cultivars like rice, maize, barley, wheat, you know, these in different parts of the world, it's a different version of an annual grass, really, is what it is. So that appears somewhere, it begins around 15,000 years ago, and then we really start domesticating animals, give or take, 8,000 to 10,000 years ago.
Okay.
So we're probably drinking dairy as adults as early as 10,000 years ago. The earliest example of making cheese is 8,000 years ago, probably making butter for 6,000 years. The earliest domesticated animal beyond ourselves is probably dogs at 25 to 30,000 years ago, and part of it probably for food and companionship and safety. But I believe since we're talking about domestication, if your definition of domestication is you take a species and put it in a cultural environment where you're protecting it and changing it and feeding it and doing things that's not necessarily natural.
And leveraging it,
and
right.
And protecting, doing all these things. And then over time, it biologically changes, genetically changes, sometimes to the point where it can't take care of itself outside of that environment. If that's the definition, then the first domesticated species on the planet is us at 3.5 million years ago. Because we start putting ourselves in a culturally created environment by the tools and mm-hmm. the technologies that we create.
That's an interesting
fascinating.
Well, we can't.
Yeah.
Think about it. We can't. If you took all of our technologies away, you cannot survive. Humans can't survive anywhere on the planet.
Sure.
We need technology to feed ourselves. So we've domesticated ourselves. But beyond that, so that begins to change.
Well, but I also think, you know, when I was reading the information you sent over beforehand, it's important to really say what you mean by technology is the broadest possible definition of tools and
sure.
things that we use to make, cook, get, kill, dig up, plant food. So,
but don't underestimate the power of striking two rocks together.
Right, but I'm saying that was the first, you know, that, the wheel, you know, all technology. Just.
But I will say, in my mind, when things really started going to hell, and this is going to perhaps sound strange, but give me a second, is in the late 1800s.
Okay.
Turn of the century, really, when Charles Atwater invented the calorimeter.
The what?
The calorimeter.
Okay.
And that's the machine that allowed us to determine how many calories were in food, really. And the reason I say that is because that's the moment, and everything after that, that we started driving a huge wedge between food and us. You know, all of a sudden we've taken... Now, right now, I guarantee I put this... when I put this bread on the table, you guys were looking at that, and you were thinking, how many calories, how much gluten, how many carbohydrates...
No, I was thinking, how much can I eat before my wife yells at me?
Yes and no. I'm not thinking calories. I don't think about calories at all. But I think about carbs.
Okay, that's
right.
That's my point.
Right. So yeah, my head goes to, I eat for a living. That's what I do. And when I eat for a living, when I go out to eat for my work, I eat pretty well. But on my off hours, I have to be careful, and so I have to watch what I take. And I understand my body enough to know that I have to watch carbs, because my body just doesn't process them the way it should be.
Certainly. And I only bring up the calories because it's the first thing we identified in the food. And then later on, we isolated carbohydrates and protein and fat
sugars
and vitamins.
And all that, right.
But what that did, it sounds like we're getting all this extra information about food. But the byproduct of that is...
It's scaring us off.
We're looking at food and not seeing food. We're seeing, quantities and numbers of these different things.
Sure.
And the problem is that in order to get those numbers... You need to have a high-dollar calorimeter or a PhD or access this equipment. But more and more problematic is once you have those numbers, you need somebody to translate that information to tell you need this many calories, you should have this. And it keeps taking control away and away and away from people. And they no longer look at a loaf of bread and see a loaf of bread. They see a whole bunch of carbohydrates. And it isn't the way we've disempowered everyone through that process.
Interesting.
We're the only species on the planet that hires people to tell us how to eat, and we're the sickest species on the planet. The only species that are close to being as sick as us because of the food that they eat are our pets.
I was going to say dogs.
Because we feed them people diets.
Right.
I mean, really, it's insane. And what I think we should do is, again, focus on those things that has literally built us as humans over 3.5 million years and look at resources, do everything that we can, no matter what the resource is, to get the most amount of nutrition out of it before it even touches our lips, and focus on getting the most amount with the least amount of work.
Well, but let me bring up another component of eating that definitely wasn't a part of eating hundreds of thousands of years ago, and that is the pleasure of food, right? So there is more than just gaining nutrition now from food. And let's forget about McDonald's. Let's forget about the crap food and stuff like that. But I mean, there is the sitting down at the table. There is breaking bread, literally,
absolutely,
right, with people. It is an experience and it is a part of community. So you have this whole other level that food is now a part of. The Super Bowl just happened. People have Super Bowl parties. There's all this food out there. So how do we negate all that? Navigate all that? How do we navigate how food is now a part of our daily lifestyle, not just a way of gaining nutrition?
That's a super important point. In fact, my entire year last year was spent on just that. I'll tell you about it in just a moment.
Okay.
But first, I don't think that's new. The pleasure surrounding eating, the community, religion and traditions built around, I think that is very, very, very old. Certainly it's a major part of life today, but I think so in the past as well.
Mm-hmm.
I said before that I think we should definitely look into the past 300,000 years ago, even further, to gain that platform, to create that context in which we should view food and diet.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't stop there, because even if there was one diet 300,000 years ago, which there certainly wasn't, and even if I knew what it was, and even if I could convince you that was the best diet for us to eat as humans, biologically, I might get you to eat it right now. And you might even wake up tomorrow and eat it. But a week from now, you wouldn't. It doesn't matter how important it is.
I'm sorry, finish.
The other part of it is the cultural piece, like you mentioned. We are the same biologically that we have been forever, but culturally we are very, very different. We are different than we were 5 years ago. We're different than we were 300,000 years ago. So any meaningful dialogue about how to move forward to improve issues of diet and health and sustainability, all this has to take both of those into account. Mm-hmm. The cool thing is, good food done well meets all those things.
Right.
And most traditional diets were built.
So let's talk about what good food is.
This is what happens at home, too.
What is considered good food?
It isn't about the thing. It shouldn't. I don't think these discussions should be focused on barley or organ meats. It's a much larger picture.
Sure.
Okay, what do I have around me? Mm-hmm. And what do I do to get the most amount from that food?
Right, but let's just say, like, you hunt and you do mm-hmm. all these things, but, like, we don't hunt. Most people don't hunt or aren't regularly going out to attain their own food that way.
Sure.
We're going to the grocery stores. So how do we become better participants?
Better gatherers.
Yes.
Better gatherers.
How do we be better?
Well, first off, I do think some of those things that people don't normally do should be a part of our lives, even if it's once a year. Mm-hmm. It's foraging. My favorite, I do a lot of foraging classes. My favorite one is that I do it at the Hill Center every year in D.C.
Right. Didn't you just do... Wait, are you doing one soon?
I'm doing one in a couple months.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And it's one of my favorite ones because we go out all over D.C. Mm-hmm. and we just forage. We're not going in the middle of the woods. We're not going in the middle of a field. We're foraging mm-hmm. in the cracks of the sidewalks and the vacant lots, and you get... Most of the people that come live in the hill area. Mm-hmm. So, for me, it's very rewarding because they walk that same walk every single day. Now they walk it through new eyes.
Right.
If they're not stepping on something or hitting it with Roundup, they realize that it's more nutrient dense than anything. So I think foraging is a very easy way mm-hmm. to reconnect and learn. I think even if it's just fishing or clamming or whatever, crabbing is great. Hunting is fantastic if done the right way. But... the magic that can happen in the kitchen is something that I think we need to reconnect with. So one of the things that I started doing about 12 or so years ago was trying to learn to cook, and this is that diving in a little too deep thing, cooking everything 100% from scratch. In fact, there was a year that...
So were you grinding your own grain?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
We built a wood-fired oven in the backyard, baking all our bread out of the wood-fired oven, and we made the decision never to buy bread again, and other than maybe 5 loaves over 10 years, we haven't... butchering our own animals, curing our own meat. There was a year that I said every single thing in my kids' lunchboxes was going to be made 100% from scratch at home. Now, it was way over the top. And I did it. We were curing all the meats. I was making all the cheeses, all of it.
It's impressive.
But no, I drove everybody nuts.
I'm sure it did.
It was too far.
You're going to be in counseling soon. You know this.
but here's the thing that I found out about that. By learning to make the basics of what you eat every day, 100% from scratch, mm-hmm. was the most eye-opening experience I could imagine. What I suggest is you take... And first off, one thing I realize is that it's the things that are eaten every day that make the biggest difference. It's the bread in my kids' lunchboxes that they sure. eat every day for their entire time in school, which makes... It's not the going all out and making this amazing Sunday night meal once a week or once a month. It does nothing. It's something that, you know, every day, making the mayonnaise, making the butter, making the bread, whatever. But the other thing that I think is very important is an eye-opening and empowering is to take the things that you truly eat every day. I don't care if it's macaroni and cheese or hot dogs and french fries. Take those things and learn to make them 100% from scratch. Even if you only do it once, even if you screw it up, mm-hmm. when you walk into the grocery store, you peel back that veil that all the advertisers, all the companies are putting between you and your food, and you can actually see what's there. And I'll give you a great example. So I'm fairly passionate about cheese. I love cheese. I make the cheese for years. Last year in Ireland, where I lived, we had access to raw milk directly from the cow, never cooled down, warm, 2-minute walk. I was making cheese minimum once a week the entire year, all different cheeses. And I came back here, and obviously I'm in Maryland, and we don't have the same access to milk here as we did there.
Well, there is a raw milk push.
And I'm right behind it, 100%. Okay. My kids have been on raw milk their whole lives. But mm-hmm. that's a whole milk. Anyhow, so I got back, and without a lot of access to the milk, we went across the bridge, the Bay Bridge, for the first time when we were back in August. And I went to Trader Joe's and Whole Foods and looking in at the cheese section. And I picked up the mozzarella, mm-hmm. you know, the balls of mozzarella in the plastic. And I turned it over. This was in Trader Joe's. And I looked at all of them there, and over half of them shouldn't even be cold cheese. They shouldn't. I mean, the balls. I mean, looking at the balls of mozzarella.
Why?
Well,
because of what's in it?
Because it isn't a fermented cheese. It's not a real cheese. So
because it's pasteurized.
No, because it was pasteurized, but that's not why. And Whole Foods is the same. When you make mozzarella or any of the pasta filata stretch curd cheeses,
yes,
provolone, provola, caciocavallo, whatever, mozzarella, you have to get the pH to 5.2 and heat up the curds, and then they'll stretch. At any other pH, it won't stretch. Any other temperature, won't stretch. That's the only thing you can do to make it stretch. Mm-hmm. And the way it's made is you take the milk. If it's raw, you just let it go. If it's not raw, you put in whatever to start it, you know, the bacterial work, and put in rennet so it separates into curds. Curds and whey. And then over time, over 6 to 8 hours, the pH will drop as the lactic acid builds up through the fermentation. The bacteria are eating, it's a lactic fermentation, they're eating lactose, mm-hmm. right? And then the pH drops. And when it gets to 5.2, you stretch, you make the cheese. 6 to 8 hours. A lot of chemical things, processes are happening during that time.
Naturally.
Naturally. The other way you can do it is to throw citric acid or vinegar into it, drop the pH in seconds, mm-hmm. and then you can stretch the curds. They look the same. They taste almost the same. The texture's similar.
But you don't have the nutritional value.
And this is the one thing that a lot of people that have lactose issues are coming up to me and asking, listen, I get the whole thing. I'm eating aged cheeses and cheeses, and most cheeses are fine for me, but I don't get it. Sometimes I eat pizza and it's fine, and sometimes I eat pizza and I have all sorts of issues. And that's exactly the reason. They're two different foods. So by making that cheese, even once, you can walk in there, and I don't care if it's in the nice package. I don't care if it's in Whole Foods. You're looking at it, and you can make the determination for yourself whether this is cheese or not. Same thing.
So if you see citric acid, you know that it's not made correctly.
If you see citric acid, it's been made in seconds as opposed to hours. And it's the same thing with bread. The bread I made for you today took me a day and a half to make, and there's a lot of chemical things. You know, a lot of things happen to that bread to make it more digestible and make it safer for us to eat and unlock the nutrients in it. Wonder Bread is made in an hour, start to finish. I mean, literally from grain to being in the package.
Let's be honest, Wonder Bread isn't really bread.
No. But when we have discussions about what we should be eating, we use the term bread, or we mm-hmm. say cheese. And it's a ridiculous conversation because we're not diving in deep enough
to really discuss what they really are. Yeah. Well, we only have a couple minutes left.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about the Eastern Shore Food Lab.
Absolutely.
And what you're doing there.
All right. I'm so excited about this initiative. It started mm-hmm. about 8 years ago. So I teach at Washington College. It's a wonderful little private liberal arts college in Chestertown, Maryland. And doing all sorts.
Which is a gorgeous little area.
It's a gorgeous area. It's the first college founded after we became, declared our independence, 1782. Gorgeous place. And one of the cool things about the college is that it's situated in a unique environment on the Eastern Shore, right on the Chester River. We have a 5,000-acre field research campus farm. We have a Center for Environment and Society, which is doing wonderful things in the environment. And we made the decision a few years ago to also focus on using food to connect people with their past, with their present, and with their environment. So the Eastern Shore Food Lab, we just launched right around Thanksgiving this year. So we're fairly new. It's located right in downtown Chestertown, and they're in town so that we have students coming down into town, and we have the public and the community, you know, taking advantage of it as well. And it's focused on all of the things that I talked about today, connecting people with their past, learning all of those technologies in ways that are applicable in their own kitchens and in their own lives. So we have a huge wood-fired oven.
Restaurant? Like, do people come in and eat? How do people use this lab?
There's several different. What we created. There's no short answer because we created a very versatile space.
Okay.
It's the first thing I can tell you is it's a place to connect with food, and that's maybe the best description. There's no walls. It's wide open. The only doors that are there, other than the bathrooms and the walk-ins, are three fermentation and curing rooms. One's for meat, one's for cheese, one's for lacto-fermented vegetables. But they have glass doors so you can see. The whole thing is about connection.
So do you do classes?
We do.
Okay.
So it's about teaching and connecting. So there's courses and workshops and classes and presentations. And we had the head chef and president of the Italian Culinary Institute launch us a couple months ago. Fantastic guy, John Nocita. So you can expect a number of different, we're bringing specialists in and we're doing our own courses as well for students and the public.
Mm-hmm.
We have our own students running through there in a number of different ways. We have student interns that are embedded in there, and we support other classes as well. The idea is that we haven't set up a culinary school. That's not the focus. The focus is to take all of our different majors, whether the students are going to end up being teachers or lawyers or doctors or whatever, and they're going through our space mm-hmm. in a number of different ways, and then going back to their majors and then going back to their professions through with completely different eyes about their food and diet and their place in the world. And then we also are creating a community supported kitchen through that space as well. So there is going to be real output of food.
So does mm-hmm. it make sense then as a next step for you to start connecting like with the Culinary Institute so that the chefs who are students can, I mean, this becomes, they become inculcated, as I'm saying that, right, with the whole mission and vision.
Absolutely. In fact, we've already started doing that by going off campus. So I went to the Italian Culinary Institute several years ago for an amazing...
Schindler's not Italian.
It's a long story, but it's Stamato is.
Stamato.
Yes, Stamato.
Di dove? Where in it? Where in Italy?
No. After the show. Right. After 3 minutes left. Oh my God.
So we, anyhow, this amazing chef that owns the Italian Culinary Institute, his head chef there, John Nocita. I went there for a Italian salumi course, mm-hmm. 10 days. It was fantastic. And partway through, we got to talk, and he realized what I did, and I really liked the way he approached food. And anyhow, he's been bringing me back once or twice a year for his master's programs to teach a 3-day course. And we start, so for his chefs that he's training, we start by banging rocks, making stone tools, butchering with them, and then finding ways to take... They're making fire by hand.
Fun.
It's wonderful.
Okay, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up. So tell people where they can find you and learn more about all of this. Because
go to Chestertown, Maryland, look for the guy running around in a loincloth.
Don't laugh.
throwing rocks at geese.
Right.
I mean, that's the guy.
Okay, stop.
So I'm based out of Washington College. You can find us online very easily, washingtoncollege.com. If you want the Eastern Shore Food Lab, it's washingtoncollege.com/ESFL. You can find information. We're on all over social media at ES Food Lab for Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So we're posting all of our events on there, and you can find out much more information. And all of my Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter is at Dr. Bill Schindler, Dr. Bill Schindler.
Thank you so much. This has been an incredibly fascinating conversation today. And we want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us today. This is David and Nikki Nellis of Industry Night. We are at the fabulous Lion Hotel, which is totally rocking tonight. Join us next week because we will be talking with the curator of the Tudor House. And if you are traveling to DC and have never been to the Tudor House, or if you live here and have never been there, it is an incredible, incredible museum that has been through multiple families since the 1700s. And the curators there have this extensive history. It sort of goes hand in hand a little bit with what we've been talking about today, mm-hmm. About the parties they threw, the decorations they had, how they ate, and they show everything through different spans of years. So every year they pick something different and then set up the house to how it looked then. It's fascinating. So we're looking forward to that conversation next week. You can download our shows on iTunes. And, of course, you can hear us every Sunday live on 1500 AM for Foodie and the Beast, our other variety show. And you can follow me at...
It's exhausting.
Stop. You can follow me at Nikki Nellis, NYCCINELLIS. Thanks for joining us today and have a delicious week.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.